Greetings on this, the 25th day of September of 2019. We find ourselves just a few weeks into the second year of the Narrative Lectionary. I am Pastor John Nelson, coming to you today from Ebenezer Lutheran Church. The appointed reading for this coming Sunday comes to us from Exodus chapters 1, 2, and 3. We skip around a little bit. We start with Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, and go through chapter 2, verse 10. We then skip over the second portion of Exodus chapter 2, and we take up the narrative again in Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15. So, I read. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase. And in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. The Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." On to chapter 3, verses 1 to 15. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight, and see why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses!" And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." He said further, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain. But Moses said to God, If I come to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. He said further, Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Thus you shall say to the Israelites, The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, just for a little bit of literary context, last Sunday we took a look at Genesis chapter 32. Jacob on his return to Esau, and he has this encounter by the river Jabbok, where he wrestles a mysterious figure, a man, a messenger, an angel, God, and has his name changed from Jacob to Israel. What we skip over at the end of Genesis then is Jacob settling then in the land near and around Canaan, and he's there with his wives and his children, 12 sons and a daughter, and we get then the story of Joseph, the dreamer, and Joseph's dreams make his brothers jealous, and they end up selling him into slavery into Egypt, where he is first brought up to be the head of a household, an important household in Egypt, and then brought low because of Potiphar's wife. He finds himself in prison for a while until, from the depths of that experience in prison, he ends up essentially becoming the chancellor of the exchequer of Egypt. He becomes Pharaoh's right-hand man, and he is able to foresee coming famine and set aside food to last through the lean years. And this ends up being the means by which he will be reunited with his brothers, and eventually Jacob and all of his sons and his families will move down to Egypt into an area known as Gershon, which is a fairly fertile land. It goes to show you how important Joseph had become. He's able to settle his family in kind of prime real estate for farming, kind of in the delta of the River Nile. And the people of Israel there grow and they thrive. And they're there for multiple generations, 400 or 500 years likely pass. And then we find ourselves with the dynastic change in Egypt. And this is something that we can verify from history, that somewhere in the neighborhood of 1300 before Christ, there is a dynastic change in Egypt. And if we took a look at the very first couple of verses of Exodus, we would find that this new dynasty, this new pharaoh, does not know Joseph, does not know how Joseph saved the people of Egypt from famine, and they have no connection to that story. They have no connection to the Hebrews, to the people of Israel, to these resident aliens who have this prime, fertile land in Egypt. And so this new pharaoh is nervous about these resident aliens, and probably also a little bit envious of the prime real estate that the people of Israel have. And so he decides to act shrewdly, as the narrative, as the New Revised Standard Version, the translation that I use, puts it. Pharaoh tells his people, we're going to act shrewdly to deal with these resident aliens, and they end up oppressing them. But it seems that no matter how much the Egyptians oppress the people of Israel, the Hebrews, they are still fruitful, and they multiply, and they continue to grow. And this just continues to make Pharaoh and the Egyptians quite nervous. And so eventually, this new Pharaoh with no connection to the Hebrews, this new Pharaoh with no connection to how Joseph helped Egypt, decides that any sons born of the Hebrews should be killed. And this not only deprives the Israelites of soldiers and a potential rebellious army, but this may also be an attempt to erase the people of Israel as an ethnicity entirely, because if girls are allowed to live, then of course they can intermarry with Egyptians, and over time those people of Israel will become intermixed and intermarried with the Egyptians. Which got me to thinking, I know that Jewish ethnic identity is matrilineal. This is established in the book of Ezra. If a child is born to a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father, the child is considered Jewish. However, if a child is born to a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, the child is not considered Jewish. So in the book of Ezra, we have matrilinealism established. So if your mother's Jewish, you are automatically Jewish. And it got me to wondering a little bit if that was the roots of that being established in Ezra can be found here in Egypt with the death of Hebrew boys, which would have made it difficult for the ethnic identity to continue in Egypt. That's just purely speculative, but it's a possibility. So Pharaoh orders these two midwives, one whose name is Shiphrah, which in Hebrew means fairness, and the other who is named Puah. The meaning of that name is uncertain. He orders these two wives to kill Hebrew boys, and they don't do it. They defy Pharaoh, and they lie to Pharaoh. They say the Hebrew women are so vigorous in childbirth that by the time we get there, the children are already born, and they're taken care of, and we cannot do as you have asked us to do. So this is interesting for a couple of reasons in the culture of the time, both the Egyptian culture and in the Hebrew culture. You know that someone is important when they are named. And if you take a look at the first chapter of Exodus, you'll discover that Pharaoh is not named. Pharaoh has the title, Pharaoh, but we don't know Pharaoh's name. And instead, we have these two midwives who are probably fairly unimportant people, and women to boot, who are named. So these are important characters because they do something rather amazing. They defy the supreme power of Egypt, Pharaoh. They put their own lives in danger in order to save Hebrew baby boys. And this is just rather astounding considering the place of women in the culture both of Israel and in Egypt. So, and this isn't the only time we're going to see women taking on kind of a defiant and important role in the life of Israel. As a matter of fact, it's going to happen in the very next chapter, in chapter 2. Because we have a man and a woman from the house of Levi that will become important a little later on in the life and story of Moses and Israel. A man and a woman of the house of Levi have a child, and this child is apparently very a fine baby, as the translation puts it. The child's mother hides him for 3 months and then eventually puts him in a reed or papyrus basket. And it's interesting because the Hebrew there for basket is actually the same word as gets translated earlier on in Genesis as ark. So it's this it's a vessel by which someone is saved. So the baby Moses is placed in this ark in the River Nile by this Hebrew mother who is defying the orders of Pharaoh, and Moses's older sister, who we will is not named, but who we will later come to suspect is Miriam, is watching over him as he is in the River Nile. And it just so happens that the Pharaoh's daughter discovers this reed basket, hears Moses crying, discovers the basket, and then decides to take this Hebrew child into her own household. And I just imagine Moses' sister, perhaps Miriam, coming up to the Pharaoh's daughter and offering to find a wet nurse to take care of the baby, with maybe like a wink, right? A wink and a nudge. Because, if you were Pharaoh's daughter and you discovered a baby in a basket in the river, and it just so happened that a young girl who is also of the same ethnicity as the baby in the basket came along and suggested, I could find you a wet nurse for that baby, you could probably figure out what's going on here. You probably understand that the wet nurse that's going to be found is indeed the child's actual mother. So I have a feeling there's a bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on in this scene. So Pharaoh's daughter is acting a little bit in defiance of her father as well. So we have a bunch of women here in Exodus 1 and 2 who are defying Pharaoh, and who we can understand are acting as agents of God to eventually bring this grand situation, this big story about how the people of Israel are trapped in the land of Egypt, in the house of slavery, how they're being oppressed. That's this big old situation that's going on in the world, in the life of Israel. And through the actions of these women, that big story gets narrowed down into the person of Moses. And this is going to be something that happens quite often in Scripture, that we have this grand situation going on in the world, these big events occurring, and God is going to work to bring about a person in particular who is going to address those big events that are going on in the world. Of course, we see this most easily in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We find humanity in broken sin. That's the grand, vast reality of the world. And God is going to act through surprising people, once again through women at times, to bring about the incarnation of Jesus Christ, who is going to address that major issue. But that's for later. Right, for now we've got the people of Israel in the house of slavery in the land of Egypt. They are oppressed, they are groaning and crying out for salvation, and God is working behind the scenes through unlikely people, through people who do not have much power or influence, through these various women, to bring about Moses, who is going to be the means by which God will save the people of Israel from the hand of their oppressor. Pharaoh's daughter names Moses, which means to draw out, and she explains that naming, because I drew him out of the water, which I find interesting, because in Egyptian mythology and in the Egyptian religion of the time, the Nile is the source of blessing. The Nile is an important part of Egypt's agriculture. You know, the Nile floods regularly and brings down silt and soil that makes the land in the Nile River Valley very fertile. And the early Egyptians understood that without the Nile, they would be in a great deal of trouble. And they understood the Nile then to be a source of blessing, even a source of life. And so Pharaoh's daughter draws out from the River Nile Moses, who is going to end up being a source of blessing to the people of Israel, and is going to draw out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery, from the hand of their oppressor. But first, Moses is going to have to be drawn out of Egypt. And we skip over those verses in the first chapter, or first verses of chapter 2. where we discover that Moses grows into a fine young man as a part of Pharaoh's household. Eventually, one day, he's out and about and he discovers the oppression of his people, and he sees an Egyptian taskmaster who is beating a Hebrew slave, and he doesn't really like that, and he ends up committing murder. He murders the Egyptian, and he thinks at first that he got away with it, but then the next day he intervenes between two Hebrew slaves who are fighting one another, and one of those Hebrews points out that, you know, you're a bit hypocritical here, aren't you, Moses? Yeah, we might be fighting, but you killed a guy. And so Moses realizes that his secret murder wasn't quite so secret, and Pharaoh becomes angry, and Moses has to flee. So he ends up being drawn out, to play on his name, of the land of Egypt, and he makes his way to the land of Midian, which is just kind of across the border. If you leave Egypt and go into the Sinai Peninsula and then head southeast along the coast there, that's the land of Midian. And there we skip over some more verses where Moses meets Jethro's daughter, a woman by the name of Zipporah. He ends up marrying Zipporah and becomes a member of Jethro's household, and he's tending flocks. And that is when we find our way to Exodus chapter 3, the second part of our reading, verses 1 to 15, wherein Moses is tending the flocks of his father-in-law Jethro, and he is on Mount Horeb, which is also known as Mount Sinai. As a brief aside, we don't really know the exact location of that mountain. There are all sorts of theories about that, and there are all sorts of places that claim to be Mount Sinai, and whenever you have a holy place in the Holy Land, you can bet that someone's going to come along and build a building on top of it. And 9 times out of 10, they're also going to charge admittance to that building to see that holy site. One of the places that ends up being built on one possible location of Mount Sinai is a monastery. My father shared this story Bible study this morning, Wednesday morning Bible study, about this monastery that was established on what might be Mount Sinai. And what's interesting about that monastery is one of the oldest manuscripts that we have from the New Testament was found in this monastery. And all of these manuscripts have different names to them, and that manuscript ends up becoming called the Sinaiticus manuscript, so named after Mount Sinai. But we don't really know where Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai is. But Moses is tending to his flocks, and he catches sight of this burning bush. God calls out to Moses from this burning bush. Moses sees this burning bush and is very confused because it's burning, but it's not consumed. And he has to take a look at this. And then God warns him, "Come no closer, Moses, and take off your sandals, for the land you are standing on is holy ground." Moses averts his gaze because, like Jacob, who we talked about last week, Moses understands that to look upon the face of God is to die. So Moses averts his gaze. And then God calls Moses and lays out for Moses this plan of deliverance. God intends to draw out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery, and Moses is the one who's going to do it. Moses seems a little concerned about this, and he questions God, asking, "Who am I to do this?" Which is a powerful question to ask at any time, really, isn't it? Who am I to do what you are calling me to do, God? And God responds, "Don't worry about that. I will be with you. And with me by your side, you're fine." Moses still seems to be a little bit nervous about this whole plan that God has for him. And so he then asks, "Well, then who are you? You know, if I go to the people of Israel, to the Hebrews in Egypt, and say that God has sent me, they're going to say, 'God who? God what? Huh? So who are you, God?'" So Moses asks some actually pretty powerful questions here. Who am I? And who are you? God then answers with what has become known as the Tetragrammaton, the unpronounceable name of God, Yod-Heh-Vah-Heh, which has to do with the Hebrew verb to be or to exist. And so that ends up getting translated as I am that what I am, or I am that I am, or simply I am. So Moses asks these questions about identity and existence, right? Who am I and who are you? And God answers with a name that has to do with identity and existence. Imagine asking someone, who are you? And they respond, I am. I mean, it's an interesting little back and forth that we have going on here between Moses and God. So God gives Moses this name that has to do with existence and with identity. I am what I am. I am that I am. God once again gives Moses this call. You are to go to my people and to give them this name. This is the name that I shall be known by from generation to generation. This is my title. And that's basically where we leave off in the narrative lectionary for this coming Sunday. If we were to continue on, we would discover that Moses is still not overly excited about this whole plan, and he keeps coming up with reasons why he cannot do it. But God is going to address every one of those reasons, and by providing help for Moses in various ways, and coming back again and again and again to the fact that God is going to be with Moses as he draws the people of Israel out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So as much as Moses might initially say, here I am, to God's call, he fights the call quite a bit, but God responds to every argument he makes with the reality that God will be with him no matter what. This whole experience of Moses leading the people of Israel out of the house of slavery becomes a defining moment. It's really the salvific moment in the Jewish religion, in the life of Israel. Of course, later on in the Old Testament, we're going to discover Messianic texts. But prior to the Messianic texts, prior to the Babylonian exile, the Exodus is really the defining moment in the history, in the identity, in the life of the people of Israel. And this is going to be brought up time and time and time again. The narrative lectionary that follows this one, the text that follows this one, is the Ten Commandments and what's known as the Shema. And the Shema is in Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 9. And in it, the Lord is going to remind the people of Israel that he brought them up out of their slavery, out of their oppression. And that has ramifications for their identity and how they are to live. We're going to discover quite a lot in Deuteronomy, and then in some of the prophetic writings in the Old Testament, God is very concerned with the widow, the orphan, and the resident alien. And when God talks about taking care of, in particular, the resident alien, several times God is going to say to the people of Israel, you need to be kind and welcoming to the resident alien, to the alien among you, because you were resident aliens in the land of Egypt. So basically the Lord is going to say to the people of Israel, you don't oppress others because you know what it is like to be oppressed. You were oppressed in Egypt, and because of that, you cannot oppress people within your nation, within your community. Now, the people of Israel aren't necessarily going to be all that great at doing that. And let's be honest, still today, Christians aren't particularly good at doing that. We're still awfully good at oppressing people who are different, who are resident aliens in our communities. God reminds the people of Israel that you know what it's like to be oppressed. You should not oppress others. And Jesus is going to make a remarkably similar argument in his preaching and teaching. You know what it's like to stand before judgment, right? So you should not be judging others. That's going to be one of the big arguments, one of the big teachings that Jesus is going to teach later on when we get to the gospel lessons later on in the narrative lectionary. So that's kind of an overview of what we're going to be looking at in terms of this coming Sunday, Exodus chapters 1, 2, and 3. We see God at work kind of using powerless people and broken people, using unexpected people to stand in the face of powerful people and to bring about deliverance and to bring about freedom from oppression and freedom from slavery, freedom from the hands of the Egyptians and from Pharaoh. Some people, commentators, will make much of the fact that Moses is a shepherd. This is a theme in terms of the leadership of the people of Israel, that the kings of Israel later on, David was a shepherd, and so there's a link between shepherding and being a king. It's a pastoral rule is what this idea ends up being called by commentators and theologians. So Moses being a shepherd when he encounters the burning bush says something is about that, about the pastoral rule of the leaders of Israel. They are to be shepherds of their people. And of course, that imagery is going to be picked up as well in the life of Jesus Christ, and Jesus will identify as being the good shepherd, so we're going to get that same sense of a pastoral rule, shepherding king. I think that's really some of the main things that I wanted to share with you regarding our reading for this coming Sunday from the life of Moses, Exodus chapters 1, 2, and 3. Just looking over my notes here really quickly. God's identity is wrapped up in existence. God is the source of all life. God is the source of all existence. And that gets laid out very specifically in God's name, I am that I am. Moses' questions are powerful ones. Who am I? It's a good question for us to ask. And then, who are you, God? That's another good question for us to ask as well, because the answers to those two questions say quite a bit about us and our understanding of our identity and our understanding of our relationship with God. I want to leave you with this question to ponder, and it was a question that got brought up at our Wednesday morning Bible study. So one of the verses we skip over in the latter half of Exodus chapter 2 is Exodus 2 verse 25. It reads, God looked upon the Israelites and God took notice of them. Which kind of begs the question, what took so long, God? Why did it take so long for you to notice the plight of the Israelites who are being oppressed in Egypt? And that language is going to get used again later on. But, we often feel as though maybe God doesn't see what we're going through. And that's a tough question to have to answer. And I'm not going to give you my answer to that question. If you're curious about my thoughts on that, you're welcome to email me or ask me about them next time you see me. But I want you to think about how you answer that question. Why does it feel sometimes like it takes God a long time to notice our plight? Now, let's also recognize that God does notice the plight of the oppressed, the marginalized, the resident alien, the slave, those who are being downtrodden. God does notice that. God did notice and understood and knew. That's an interesting part of the Hebrew word there, God notice. The word notice has connotations of understanding and knowing. So God understood and knew and saw, perceived the plight of the people of Israel. God does see that. Sometimes we wonder why it seems to take a while for God to see the plight of people. God does see the plight, and God will eventually draw them out through the actions of Moses and others. God will draw them out of their slavery, out of Egypt, and set them on a path towards the promised land, which will be an interesting and circuitous path, but it will end with them in the promised land as God had promised. So, how do you answer that question when it comes up? Why does it seem like God doesn't always notice the terrible things that are going on in the world? So wrestle with that question a little bit. Maybe dwell a little bit up on the life story of Moses and the people of Israel. That might help you find some answers to that difficult question. So that's all I've got this week. I hope you found some useful pieces of information and some insight, and I look forward to talking a little bit more with you next week. God bless.